Well, brethren, greetings on another Sabbath day. Good afternoon to those of you here in England, and good morning once again to those of you across the Atlantic. Today we continue with the reading and some study of the book of Exodus. Last time we got as far as Exodus chapter 11, bringing us right up to the Passover chapter. Chapter 12, which is a very detailed and a very meaty chapter. It may take us some time to get through this chapter, so we'll see how far we get today. But just before we start in Exodus 12, in the last message, we went through the first nine plagues that that God struck Egypt with, the plague of the waters turning to blood, and you remember the flies and the frogs and the boils and the hail or meteors and so on. And people have always asked the question, well, you know, if Egypt, which was a mighty empire, was destroyed by such powerful plagues and catastrophes, wouldn't the Egyptians have kept some record of that? And after all, these catastrophes brought the empire down to its virtual end. Isn't there some historic reference to these things? And people have said, well, we can't find such, therefore that indicates the Bible is all myth and fable and fairy tale. It's just Jewish stories. Well, as it happens, there is some evidence in Egyptian history. It's not totally provable, but there is the writings of a wise man, possibly a priest, who lived in Egypt around about the time of Moses. This sage or wise man, his name was Ippur. That's an Egyptian name. We would spell it I-P-U-W-E-R, Ippur. And he wrote a history, like a newspaper almost, on papyrus. There's a material that the Egyptians and ancient people wrote on, and for that reason it's called the Papyrus Ippur. And it was found about 200 years ago. And it's interesting to compare some of the writings of this man with what you find in the book of Exodus. For example, we'll remember that plague number one was the waters turning to blood all over the land. Well, here is what Ippur records on his papyrus. Plague is throughout the land. Blood is everywhere. The river is blood. Men shrink from tasting and thirst after water. End of quotation. Well, that sounds pretty much like a man who's living through the plague of the blood and recording it, you know, like in a newspaper on this papyrus. We'll remember that the plague of the pestilence on the cattle, what the King James calls a grievous murrain. Well, Ippur writes, all animals, their hearts weep, cattle moan. Again, there was the seventh plague, which was the hail, if you remember, or it might have been meteors that crashed down, broke and destroyed all the trees, and there was flames and fire mingled with the hail. The flax and the barley were smitten by this powerful heavy hail. Well, Ippur records, trees are destroyed. No fruit or herbs are found. Gates, columns and walls are consumed by fire. Grain has perished on every side. That has perished which was seen yesterday. End of quote. So he's saying, look, you know, there was grain and crops yesterday, but today they're gone. You know, a sudden dramatic catastrophe. Always remember the plague of the darkness, remember, the ninth plague, where 3 days there was no light. The papyrus Ippur records, the land is not light, or the land is without light. And the one we're about to read in a few moments is the final plague, the tenth plague. You'll recollect that we know the firstborn throughout Egypt were killed. the firstborn in the palace, the firstborn in the dungeons, the firstborn of the livestock. Well, here's what Papyrus Ippur records. Children of princes are dashed against walls. Children of princes are cast out in the streets. The prison is ruined. He who places his brother in the ground is everywhere. It is groaning throughout the land, mingled with lamentations. You know, it says there that he who places his brother in the ground is everywhere, meaning that everybody has got dead people to bury. So it's just interesting that papyrus appear might well be a first-hand account by an Egyptian wise man who literally lived through the 10 plagues, didn't quite understand, of course, what was taking place, but actually wrote his record down, and that's now been found after all those thousands of years, and it's available to read. Okay, let's start now in Exodus chapter 12, verse 1. And we're looking at the events leading up to the 10th plague and the Passover. Verse 1. Now the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, "This month," the one we're now in, "shall be your beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you." One of the first things God had to straighten out with the Israelites was when he wanted his year to begin. It seems that the Egyptians began their year in the summertime, when the river Nile would overflow. But God wasn't having that for his particular calendar. And so he was saying, "Look, Moses, this month that we're now in, this is going to be the first month of the year in the calendar that you will use from now on." Verse 3. "Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take for himself a lamb, according to the house of his father, a lamb for a household." And this lamb was taken on day number 10. "And if the household is too small for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next to his house take it according to the number of the persons. According to each man's need, you shall make your count for the lamb." Verse 5. "Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year," a young lamb, a male lamb, and not one which is deformed with a broken leg or a twisted hip. It's got to represent something very special, this lamb. So young, if you like, still representing innocence and without any blemish, without any fault in its appearance. "You may take it from the sheep, or if you haven't got sheep, from the goats." Now, of course, we know the story already, but we do recognize and should be reminded that this lamb without blemish does represent a very special and important being, the one who became our Passover. If we turn to 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 19, it's just worth reading this one verse. First Peter chapter 1, and just reading verse 19 only. We read here, "But with the precious blood of Christ, as of a lamb without blemish and without spot." You know, Jesus Christ was the Lamb of God. Jesus Christ, as we'll find out, is and was our Passover lamb. He was the sacrifice that redeemed us. And so this little lamb that was taken by ancient Israel and to be killed by them and so on, it did represent, you know, Jesus Christ, a lamb without blemish and without spot. Okay, back to verse 5. "So your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. Take it from the sheep or from the goats. Now you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month." So you select the particular lamb, you appoint it or ordain it, if you like, on day 10. And then you keep it for 4 days, at which point, you know, it will be slain and sacrificed. And the people have brought out that there does seem to be a a hint there of the bigger picture applying to Jesus Christ, because Jesus Christ, if you like, was finally ordained to be sacrificed at the time of the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve made the wrong choice in the Garden of Eden, when they took the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, when they rejected their Creator and His guidance and His revealed knowledge and chose to go their own way. At that point, they sinned. And at that point, Jesus Christ became definitely appointed or ordained to be sacrificed as our Passover lamb to redeem us from death. And of course, 4,000 years later, Jesus Christ was indeed slain on the very Passover day. So the lamb was taken on day 10 and kept for 4 days. 4 days representing the 4,000 years between Christ being ordained and appointed and actually being physically sacrificed. Notice again verse 6, you shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. The Hebrew there is as far as the 14th day, not beyond it, but up until the 14th day. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at twilight. Now, there are many arguments, there are many debates among brethren in the churches of God as to exactly when was this twilight period. The King James Version says, kill it in the evening. Oh, say some people, that's the beginning of the 14th. No, say some other people, it's the evening which is at the end of the 14th. And so people start to debate and argue, do we keep the Passover celebration on the 14th or on the 15th? And arguments have raged and will continue, no doubt, till Christ returns. This expression here, at twilight, is how the New King James Version, which I'm reading, translates it. The King James Version says, in the evening. If you look at the New American Standard Bible, it says, at twilight. If you look at the Young's Literal Translation, it says, between the evenings. In other words, kill the lamb between the evenings, plural. The Darby translation, a man called Darby from England, he translates it, between the two evenings. The Jewish Publication Society translates it, at dusk. And even the Spanish version says, entre las dos tardes, between the two evenings. When is that period? Well, I think most of us would probably accept that the sun sets and begins the new day as the sun sets. That's the beginning of evening. And then when it's totally dark, that's the second evening. So between the two evenings is that twilight period, dusk. And that's, of course, how many translations translate it. Dusk or twilight. You know, you have the daytime, the sun is shining, the sun drops down below the horizon, and that's it. The evening has begun officially, the next day has begun, but it remains quite light, but getting increasingly duller and gloomier and duskier, until eventually after perhaps 45 minutes, an hour, hour and a half, it's pitch black. It's dark. It is nighttime. And that period of perhaps 1 hour, 1.5 hours duration is twilight or dusk. Or in Scotland we used to call it the gloaming. And that period is when the lamb was to be killed. Between the two evenings. At dusk. At twilight as the 14th day began. Now some would argue, oh no, it's late in the 14th in the afternoon. And that's because the Jewish rabbis, the Pharisees, try to teach that the first evening begins round about 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and that the second evening is sunset. So as far as they're concerned, you slay the lamb at perhaps round about 2 o'clock, half past 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, not in the evening. Now, I've written quite a long article on that. When should we keep Passover? That's on our webpage, or you could ask for a copy if you wish. But that explains in considerable detail exactly why the twilight period at the beginning of the 14th month, 14th day of the month, is exactly when this particular lamb was to be slain. Verse 7. And they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses where they eat it. So you slay the lamb and you take some of its blood, and you take that blood and you sort of paint it on the uprights and across the top of your front door. Not altogether, I would say, a particularly pleasant thing to have to do. And it wouldn't look good today if we brought out blood and smeared it over our front doors, and a day or two later it's all stained and attracting perhaps flies. Verse 8. Then they shall eat the flesh on that night. Which night? Well, it's the 14th day. The 14th day of the month. Evening has begun. They've slain the lamb. And on that night of the 14th, they will eat the flesh, roasted in fire, with unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs, or to the Americans, bitter herbs, they shall eat it. So you'd have a meal, you know, a lamb meal with unleavened bread and some herbs and so on. Quite a tasty meal, I'm sure. Do not eat it raw, nor boiled at all with water, but roasted in fire, its head with its legs and its entrails, you know, the whole lamb, I guess on a spit, and roast it and toast it, and you'll have it for your big meal in the evening. You shall let none of it remain until morning, and what remains of it until morning you shall burn with fire. As we'll see later, this reference to morning is quite important. Most of us would probably accept that the natural meaning is that if any is left over next morning at daylight, then you should burn the remains. And indeed, that's exactly what it does mean. But we'll find out again later that no, say some people, morning actually is night. It gets very confusing sometimes that how language changes. Evening apparently to the rabbis means the afternoon, and morning to the rabbis means the night. And what they say is that, Israel left at perhaps 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, even though it was nighttime, and so morning is night. Again, we'll see that doesn't quite add up a little bit later. But morning means morning, strangely enough. If we look at the Brown Driver Briggs, which is a sort of dictionary of Hebrew words and their meanings, this is how, and it's deemed to be an authoritative dictionary, this is what it says for morning. Morning means, quote, break of day, coming of sunrise, coming of daylight, end of quote. And I think we'd accept that's what you generally mean when you talk of the morning. If I say to you, tell you what, I think I'll come around in the morning, we'll have a quick coffee together, okay? You say, oh, fine, I'll see you in the morning. If I knocked your door at 2 o'clock a.m. when you're fast asleep, you'd be thinking, this guy is a nutter. He said he'd come around in the morning. I mean, I'm expecting him at 6 or 7 o'clock, not 2 a.m. So most of us understand morning in real life. But when it comes to scriptures, sometimes these simple words get bent and twisted. Verse 11. And thus you shall eat it, with a belt on your waist, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. So you shall eat it in haste. It is the Eternal's Passover. But we'll stop here again for a moment, because some are saying, well, look, they're dressed up to go, and they're to eat it quickly, in haste, urgently, because they're about to go. They're going to eat this Passover meal, and a few hours later, 2 hours later, out the door, zoom, off they go, leaving Egypt. In the night, long before morning. Well, what does it mean, you shall eat it in haste? Well, once again, this is an example of not a particularly great translation. It's not totally wrong, but it's a bit misleading. Were they indeed eating it in a hurry because they were just about to depart? The answer is no. The word there for haste in the Hebrew, you would pronounce it, I think, kipazon. Kipazon. I'll spell that in English, but it would be spelt in English as C-H-I-P-P-A-Z-O-N, kipazon. And what it means is trepidation or fear or deep awe. So the correct way to translate this would be, so you shall eat it in trepidation. You shall eat it in fear. You shall eat it in deep awe. If you think about it, as we find out in many later passages, the Israelites were not trusting in God. They disbelieved again and again and again. They complained. They said God was trying to kill them later in the wilderness. And God eventually got so fed up with their accusations, their opposition. You remember that most of them, the adults, all eventually died. They really showed themselves to have no faith, no confidence in this Jehovah who was dealing with them. And you can imagine very much that these people on this evening were in deep fear and trepidation because they'd heard about the next plague going to kill the firstborn throughout the land. Who's to say that this God being wouldn't kill them too? After all, you never know what gods are going to do. And they would have been really quite concerned. And again, they've been told, make sure you take this lamb on the 10th. Kill it between the evenings. Get the blood on your lintels and your door. What if they hadn't done that properly? What if it was the wrong type of lamb? What if the lamb had a blemish? What if they hadn't done the top of the door and only the sides? What if they hadn't done it on the 10th day but were a day late? Would God still come and kill them? I mean, there'd be plenty of fear and trepidation knowing what was about to come upon the land. We can see this expression used elsewhere in the Bible. The word for in haste here, this kipazon word, only appears three times. The verb appears once. If we turn to Deuteronomy chapter 20 and verse 3, we can see how the verb is used. And then we'll look at one verse where the noun, kipazon, is actually used. So Deuteronomy, verse 3 of chapter 20. And here we read, "And he shall say to them, Hear, O Israel, today you are on the verge of battle with your enemies. Do not let your heart faint, do not be afraid, and do not tremble or be terrified because of them." Do not tremble. That's the same word as trepidation or fear, the one that the translators translate as in haste. It is do not tremble. So to have trembling is to have kipazon. And if we turn to Isaiah chapter 52, we can see one example of the same noun as appears in Exodus. Isaiah chapter 52. Don't lose your place in Exodus. Isaiah 52 and verse 10, starting in verse 10. This is God about to demonstrate his great power, how he is our security, and so on. Verse 10, "The Eternal has made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God." God's going out to conquer and deliver. "Depart, depart, go out from there, touch no unclean thing. Go out from the midst of her, be clean, you who bear the vessels of the Eternal. For you shall not go out with haste, nor go by flight." Why? "For the Eternal will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rear guard." The word there with haste is what we've read in Exodus, and it means trepidation and fear. We could properly replace that here, verse 12, "For you shall not go out with fear or trepidation, for the Eternal will go before you, and he will be your rear guard." See, you wouldn't be fearful or in trepidation knowing that God was before you and behind you, looking after you, guarding you, being your shield, your refuge, and your protector. I think you can see that in haste is not entirely a wrong translation, because if you do have fear and trepidation that might lead you to do something in haste, for example, if you were walking along the road one day and a big lion jumped out of a bush, roared, and started chasing you, you'd have fear and trepidation. Kippahs on. Probably also, it would lead you to move with haste. So you can see that, you know, haste and fear and trepidation are sort of linked, but the fundamental meaning, the basic meaning, as in Exodus 12, is eat it with fear and trepidation. And of course, the reason for being dressed up in your traveling clothes is because after centuries of being of dwelling in Egypt, it's now time to get these people into the mindset that they are about to depart. It'd be only 24 hours later, less than that in fact. And so get dressed, start to get your mind in the right mode, start realizing deep down that your days here are at an end. You're now about to become a traveling people. So dress up for it and start pondering in your mind that within a few hours from now, you'll be leaving the country of your birth, your homes, and so on. So it's part of that special message, just to drive it deep into them that, okay, we're out of here, we're finished. Verse 12 of Exodus 12. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night. What night? Well, you keep the lamb until the 14th at twilight, and you kill it, and you eat it in that same night, and that same night God will pass through. It's the 14th of Abib. For I will pass through the land of Egypt on that night, and will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, all of them, man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Eternal. So that's now announcing precisely what this 10th plague would be. God's going to come through the land that very night after they've eaten their meal, and is going to kill, slay the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast everywhere throughout the land. Now the blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. And that's where the name comes from. You know, God was going to come through that land with the destroyer, and when they came to a house where there was no blood, the destroyer would slay the firstborn. When they came to a house where there was blood on the doors, they would pass over that house. The people inside would be saved, delivered from the destroyer because of the sign of the blood. And I think, you know, we know the parallel. Jesus Christ shed his blood for us. And in a sense, we have a little splash of blood upon us from our acceptance of Jesus Christ's crucifixion and his shed blood. We accept that shed blood. And of course, at Passover time, strangely enough, we take a little sip of red wine, picturing our acceptance of that sign, that red wine, that picture of the blood of our Savior, the Lamb of God. And so, rather than you and I heading for death, the destroyer, we are passed over. We are delivered. And of course, Passover is the 14th day of the month. And why is it called Passover? It's not because you kill a lamb. You know, some people say that, okay, you kill the lamb on the 14th, but the Passover came on the 15th. And, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. The 14th is called the Passover, not because you kill a lamb on the 14th. The Israelites had killed lambs, you know, every day, every week, for centuries. They had, you know, lamb dinners quite frequently. Killing a lamb was nothing special. Eating a lamb was nothing special. Eating a lamb with unleavened bread and herbs was nothing special. That doesn't make anything the Passover. The Passover is called the Passover, and the 14th is called the Passover because that's the day, or the night, to be more accurate, when God passed over the children of Israel. Now getting to verse 14. So this day shall be to you a memorial. Which day? This also causes some problems. Is that talking about the Passover? Look in verses 6 to 13. Has all been about the 14th day, the Passover. Is that what verse 14 is talking about? It says, so this day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Eternal throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. Now, what day is the memorial? What day is the feast? What day is the feast by an everlasting ordinance? The 14th, Passover, or the 15th, beginning of unleavened bread? If we read verse 15, it says, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. Okay, so we're now talking about the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And we know the first day and the seventh day are holy days. Now in verse 14, it says, this day shall be to you a memorial. Is that talking of the Passover that we just read about? Was it talking about what comes next? The Feast of Unleavened Bread, beginning with the 15th. What's the answer? Well, notice, it does refer to a feast. This day shall be to you a memorial, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Eternal throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance. This is a feast day to be kept really forever. It's an everlasting ordinance. Which day is that? Well, if we turn to Numbers chapter 28, we can see it clearly laid out. Numbers chapter 28, and read verses 16 to 17 when we get there. Verse 16, Numbers 28. On the 14th day of the first month is the Passover of the Lord. Oh, well, we know that. And on the 15th day of this month is the feast. Unleavened bread shall be eaten for 7 days. So the 14th day is the Passover, but the 15th day is the feast. And remember, the Passover is when God passed over. That's where the name comes from. The 14th day is the Passover, and on the 15th day is the feast. Okay, let's go back now to Exodus 12 and verse 14. The New King James says, so this day shall be memorial. The King James says, and this day shall be to you memorial. You shall keep it as a feast. Well, okay, the 14th is Passover, and the 15th is the feast. We just read that in Numbers 28. So it's a slightly awkward verse. You've got verses 6 to 13 describing Passover. You've got verses 15 to 17 describing the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And verse 14 sits right in the middle. It could refer to what goes before it or what comes after it. Well, Jusenius, who has a sort of a dictionary of Hebrew words. Those of you who came through the Philadelphia Church of God would be perhaps fed up hearing of Jusenius and Thayer sprinkled around quite a lot. And I don't often use it myself, but it's quite helpful here because it talks about this day. Which day? Jusenius points out that the meaning of the word this in Hebrew, this is what he says, quote, this pronoun may be used as referring to that which precedes, or as is more common to that which follows, end quote. So Mr. Jusenius points out that when it talks about this day, it could refer to what went before, but as is more common in Hebrew, to refer to that which follows. And so ultimately, you have to go by the context. But the most common usage in Hebrew of This day means the one I'm about to describe to you, the one which follows. And so that makes it hopefully sort of doubly clear. First of all, it's the feast day that's being described here, which is the 15th. And secondly, in Hebrew, it's normally referring to the description which comes afterwards. Verse 15. Seven days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses. For whoever eats the leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. And it does say, by the way, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. Some people have argued that, well, it just means that when you're eating bread in that period, it should be unleavened. But if you go for a day without eating bread at all, don't worry about it. Well, I'd prefer to go by the words of Scripture, and it does say you shall eat it for 7 days. So I always make sure that at least somewhere on each of the 7 days that I eat a small amount at least of unleavened bread. If you think about it, you know, the whole idea of keeping the feast is to help us to renew our minds. We're in this world, we're doing worldly things, we're caught up in our jobs and our housekeeping and so on. Now God's trying to get us to change our thinking, to refresh and renew our minds with His Word. Part of that, He's given us the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days. You know, if we go for a day or two without eating unleavened bread, is it just possible that we just perhaps forget that it is the days of unleavened bread? Our minds elsewhere? Surely the fact that we make the effort deliberately to partake somewhere in the day of unleavened bread, and as we, you know, bite into it, it should just help to focus our minds. Oh, of course. Oh, yes. That's right. Today is the fourth day of unleavened bread. Oh, right. Oh, cool. Oh, yeah. Today is the fifth day of unleavened bread. Only two more days to go. So as we make the effort and are sort of diligent to eat unleavened bread every day, it's just a physical way God's trying to get us to focus and concentrate and remember. Verse 16. On the first day, there shall be a holy convocation. That's day 15. And on the seventh day, there shall be a holy convocation for you. No manner of work shall be done on them, but that which everyone must eat. That only may be prepared by you. So you shall observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for on this same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore, you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. Okay, it tells us there that on this same day, which is an everlasting ordinance, this is the day when God brought Israel out of the land of Egypt. Which day was that? That's easy enough. If we turn to Numbers chapter 33 and verse 3, Numbers 33 and verse 3. They departed from Ramesses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month. On the day after the Passover, the children of Israel went out with boldness in the sight of all the Egyptians. So it tells us there that it was the 15th day when God took them out of the land of Egypt, and the 15th day is a memorial, the feast that we are to observe. And notice, by the way, it's the day after the Passover, not the morning after, but the day after. If they were taken out on the 15th, the Passover was the day before, which was clearly the 14th. It all ties together. If we won't turn there, but Deuteronomy 16:1 tells us that they actually went out at night time. And some might say, aha, how could the Egyptians have seen them go? It was nighttime. Well, of course, the 15th day of any month in God's calendar is the full moon. And the full moon is superbly bright. Just this past a few days, I think probably 10 days ago, the full moon was over here, and you could see for miles across the fields. that the full moon is fabulously brilliant, and it'd be no problem for the Egyptians, who were keen to see the back of Israel, to watch under the full moon as they made their way out of the land. Okay, back to Exodus chapter 12. And we're now into verse 18. I'm taking time to go over some of these points because, as I said at the beginning, there is much dispute and debate among God's people about whether Passover is the beginning of the 14th or the end of the 14th, and whether you eat the meal only on the 15th, and so on and so forth. So hopefully covering some of these points will just help us to be reassured that our traditional understanding that we got, most of us I guess, from Mr. Armstrong, in fact this stacks up with Scripture, even in the details. Verse 18, in the first month, on the 14th day of the month, that evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. That looks a bit puzzling. The 14th to the 21st at evening. Well, how many days of unleavened bread are we keeping here? Surely, you know, the 15th is the first day of unleavened bread, through to the 21st. But here it says, on the 14th day at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread. Does that mean that evening really is the end of the day? Is that the tail end of the 14th? Oh, what does this mean? We'll come back to that in a moment. Verse 19. For 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses, since whoever eats what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a native of the land. Let's look at these two verses again, then, 18 and 19. It says, on the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread. Did they do that? At the evening of the 14th, which is the beginning, remember, God's day starts at evening. At sunset, that's when God starts his days. So the evening of the 14th, where's the beginning part of the 14th? Did they eat unleavened bread? Absolutely, yes. If we look across to verse 8, talking of the Passover meal, it says, they shall roast the meal in fire and eat it with unleavened bread, and with bitter herbs they shall eat it. So the Passover meal, eaten at the beginning of the 14th at evening, was eaten with unleavened bread. So absolutely, in the first month, verse 18, on the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread. Correct. Until the 21st day at evening. Correct. But verse 19, it's only for 7 days that no leaven is found in your houses. You eat unleavened bread at Passover, at the beginning of the 14th. That's fine. But you can eat leaven products later that day. There's no penalty if you eat a slice of toast the morning after you've kept the Passover. You can have a donut at mid-afternoon. You can have a McDonald's with a burger and a bap later in the day. You're not penalized, you're not punished, because although you eat unleavened bread at the beginning of the 14th at Passover, that is not a day of unleavened bread. The 7 days of unleavened bread are what follow. And notice verse 19, for 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses. From the 15th to the 21st, the leaven is out of your house. And in those days, anybody who eats what is leavened shall be cut off or put to death. But not on the 14th day. On the 14th day, you're not cut off. Verse 20. You shall eat nothing leavened. In all your habitations, you shall eat unleavened bread. So that was God speaking to Moses and Aaron, giving them the preliminary instructions of what's about to come, to get ready and so on. And now they pass on those instructions to the rest of the Israelites, to the heads of the households. Then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, pick out and take lambs for yourselves according to your families and kill the Passover lamb, you know, when the right time comes. And you shall take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and strike the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood that is in the basin. And none of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning. You go indoors. You know, you eat your meal and you stay there. You don't leave until morning. And when is morning? as we said earlier, it's at sunrise, it's at daybreak. That's what Brown Driver Briggs says, that's what common sense tells us, and I've given a number of illustrations in my article on when do we keep the Passover. Morning means morning, daylight, daybreak. They were to stay indoors until that time. They were not to leave at what we would call 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. That wasn't their morning, that was still nighttime to them. For the Eternal will pass through to strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and in the two doorposts, the Eternal will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to strike you. So, fear and trepidation, I'll bet you. You're probably wondering, did I do it right? You know, when the middle of the night comes, whenever that is, I mean, we call midnight, and we get 11 o'clock, 11.30, 11.59, then midnight is a particular moment in our clock. And it's a legal time. You know, a child born at 5 to midnight in our calendar and a child born at 10 past midnight have got different birthdays, because to us midnight is a precise moment on our clocks, and we call the time afterwards 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. But that's just us. That's not Hebrew. That's not Egyptian. You know, their day didn't start at the hour of midnight. When it says midnight, it's just somewhere in the middle of the night. It was nighttime before the destroyer went past, and it was nighttime afterwards. It was just the middle of the night. He didn't go from the destroyer killing somebody at one moment to suddenly being morning, you know, half an hour later. It was nighttime, and this was the middle of the nighttime. Verse 24, and you shall observe this thing as an ordinance for you and your sons forever. Back talking about Passover. It will come to pass when you come to the land which the Eternal will give you, just as he promised, that you shall keep this service. And it shall be when your children say to you, what do you mean, Dad, by keeping this service? That you shall say, it is the Passover sacrifice of the Eternal, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt, when he struck the Egyptians and delivered our households. So the people who'd heard all this from Moses bowed their heads and worshipped. Then the children of Israel went away and did so, just as the Eternal had commanded them, Moses and Aaron, so they did. And, you know, some years ago, I think it was my first Days of Unleavened Bread in church, I heard a taped message from Mr. Garnet Ed Armstrong at that time. And I remember very plainly he was making a point, which I think was quite a useful point, saying, you know, that to ancient Israel, this was not seen as a religious ceremony. When Moses and Aaron said, look, take a lamb and kill it and splash the blood over your doorposts, that wasn't a religious service to the Israelites. This was a question of practical action to protect themselves from being killed, slain. And Mr. Ted Armstrong said, you know, you could liken it to perhaps he was American, of course, and he used an American example. He said perhaps the Americans would send over during the Second World War commandos who would parachute into some part of France or Germany, intent on wiping out all the Nazi supporters. And so they would parachute in by nighttime under cover of darkness, and they would go off with their bayonets and their guns to kill all the Nazi supporters. And beforehand, you would have warned perhaps the underground resistance this was happening, and you would say, look, the sign you need is to take some white paint and paint it on your doorposts, and then when the destroying army comes through the land, they will see the white paint on your doorposts and pass by that house. But if they don't see any white paint on the door, they will kick the door down and they will shoot and bayonet everybody inside. So therefore, you know, the underground resistance wouldn't see painting their doors as a religious ceremony. No way at all. It's a question of, you know, life and death, survival, and being delivered from something. And probably you'd be making sure there's plenty of white paint over your door, just in case the American was a bit sort of short sight, couldn't see very well. And so Mr. Armstrong making the point that really, to the Israelites, this was not a religious service. This was to do with living and dying, as indeed it was. Carrying on to verse 29. And it came to pass at midnight, which doesn't mean between 11:59 p.m. and 12:01 a.m. It's just the middle of the night, that the Eternal struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, it was still night, he, all his servants, and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one bed. As Mr. Epuer said, lamentations throughout the land. And you can only imagine the absolute grief. These people had been through, you know, torments in the preceding month to 7 weeks with the various plagues, you know, the boils, pretty awful, the flies, the gnats, the hail, the locusts, the darkness for 3 days that left them unable to move. And now here in the middle of the night, when you're at your most vulnerable and scared, wondering what's going to happen next, suddenly in virtually every household there's a dead person, or two dead persons, or three dead persons. Like I said last week, last time, that in this house, in this room, I'm the firstborn in my family, my wife was the firstborn in her family, and my son's the firstborn in this family. I suspect also the only born for that matter, but all three of us conceivably would be dead. So the whole household would be empty of live people. So across Egypt, this was a devastating, brutal, and complete destruction of the strength, really, of their manhood. Verse 31. Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Rise and go out from among my people, both you and the children of Israel, and go. Serve the Eternal as you have said. Also, take your flocks, take your herds, as you have said. Be gone. Go. Depart. Get lost. Clear off. And bless me also." Now, at last, you had his attention, at least for a short time. And now he's saying, "Okay, Moses, get up and go." It's quite likely that this was not a face-to-face meeting, because I think last time we read that Pharaoh said, "You'll never see my face again," was a too true blue. And what probably took place was that, some messengers were sent to Moses saying, you know, "Pharaoh's got a message for you. Get lost as soon as possible." Verse 33. And the Egyptians urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste. And that, by the way, is haste. That's like in a hurry, quickly, rapidly. For they said, "We shall all be dead. You know, tonight there's only one or two, three people dead per home. What's going to happen tomorrow night? The rest of us will be dead." So, I mean, the Egyptians didn't know that only the firstborn had been singled out. They perhaps hadn't figured out exactly what had taken place just yet. But there were dead people everywhere. And they were thinking, well, wow, another day of this, another night of this, and there'll be nobody left alive. We'll all be dead. You know, Moses, go, go, go. So the people took their dough before it was leavened, having their kneading bowls bound up in their cloths on their shoulders. At this stage, there's no evidence that Moses had mentioned to the elders of the people about the days of unleavened bread. The only part recorded that we just read was about Passover, taking the lamb and killing it and sprinkling the blood over your door and so on. So the people may not have known that there were 7 days of unleavened bread yet appointed. But because of the hurry that they were now in, and the Egyptians are more or less running them out of the country, they picked up their dough before it was any yeast and things in it, which was fine, fit in with God's plan entirely, and so on. Verse 35. Now the children of Israel had done, or King James Version says, did, according to the word of Moses, and they asked from the Egyptians articles of silver, of gold, and clothing. And the Eternal had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they granted them what they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. And obviously, if the Egyptians were keen to see the back of them in a hurry, then give them whatever you ask for. You know, take this bracelet, take this necklace, take these best jewels, take this fine garment, take these clothes, take anything you want, really, just go, go, go. And so, after, decades of slavery, now the Israelites were being, in a sense, paid for all their hard labor, and would be leaving Egypt really with a considerable amount of wealth. Verse 37. Then the children of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Sukkot, which means a tabernacle or tents, about 600,000 men on foot, besides children or infants. And you can try to work out how many there might have been altogether, if the number here was really men aged 20 or more, then there'd be all the younger men and boys below that, plus the girls and all the wives and so on. And for a time at least, of course, many of the male babies had been killed by being thrown into the Nile, so probably more females than males. But that's how you can say, well, 600,000 men, at least the same number of women, that's 1.2 million, plus several children per family and so on. It's quite easy to get to 2 to 3 to 4 million, 5 million, a large number. There was an article in the journal newspaper about a month or so back where one guy worked out he reckoned there were 10 million who left. That seems perhaps a bit top-heavy, but certainly 2, 3, 4, 5 million easily possible, and a huge number of people requiring considerable order and organization and so on. Verse 38, a mixed multitude went up with them also, and flocks and herds and a great deal of livestock. So all the gold and silver and clothing, plus oodles and oodles of sheep and goats and cows and oxen and donkeys and who knows what not. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were driven out of Egypt and could not wait, to leaven the products, nor had they prepared provisions for themselves. They didn't have any leavened products available. So they'd been forced, really, into keeping unleavened bread without any choice. For you and I, we have to make that as a decision. Are we going to keep the days of unleavened bread properly, voluntarily, of our free will? Should do. Verse 40. Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass that all the armies of the Eternal went out from the land of Egypt, the very same day as 430 years earlier. According to one of my inspired marginal notes, I can't remember now where I got it from, that says that the event being referred to 430 years earlier was when God made his covenant with Abraham, as described in Genesis 17:1. Not going to turn there, and so on. So carrying on, verse 42. This night when they escaped, because they escaped by night on the 15th day at dark, but under the full moon, of course, it says, it is a night of solemn observance to the Eternal for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Eternal, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. This is what we refer to, at least in the King James Version, as the night to be much observed. The night that Israel actually set foot on their journey out of Egypt, leaving behind the Pharaoh, bondage, slavery. And of course, you can imagine that what a fantastic night for them that would be. They had doubted and doubted right up to the last moment. They had probably eaten a meal, some of them rather scared, uncertain. But now, lo and behold, the Pharaoh and the Egyptians are letting them go. Now they've got articles of gold and silver. Now they've got herds of and flocks. Now they're leaving. They're leaving Egypt at last after all this time. They're making their way behind Moses, that fabulous prophet of God. We're off to the promised land, flowing with milk and honey. Oh, wow, fantastic. And so they would be leaving with a high hand, delighted, rejoicing. And God was taking them carefully through the dark, of course, to lead them to safe havens on the way. And this special night, this first night of the feast, is the night, it says in the King James Version, the night to be much observed. For most of my time in the church, I've called it the night to be much remembered. And I remember some years back, I think that's how it was referred to when I first came into the church, and people said, da-da-da-da-da, night to be much remembered. Where are you going for the night to be much remembered? And that's the expression I picked up, and I used it, you know, in the early years in the church. But I recollect probably about 1977, 78, 79, somewhere around about there, the minister that we had in the Church of God stood up once and he said, I don't like the way this congregation talks about the night to be much remembered. The Bible says the night to be much observed. I don't know where you picked up this expression, night to be much remembered. The Bible says the night to be much observed. In future, I do not want to hear you using that term again. In future, you will all call it the night to be much observed. Never again must any of you use the expression night to be much remembered. And I thought, that's pity, because I'd grown used to that expression, and it was a tradition now of mine after, what, 3 or 4 years in the church, I think at that stage, 5 years perhaps. And I thought, that's a shame, I got rather accustomed to that expression, but that's the minister telling us we're all wrong and we should get it right in future and do what the Bible says. And the thing that really amused me was a bit later, Mr. Armstrong tape was produced, often just a week or two earlier, and he said, okay, brethren, in 2 weeks it's a night to be much remembered. Oh, I said, oh, really? And I thought, well, I'm delighted to hear that, because I'm more comfortable with that expression. I did look across at the minister, see whether he looked at all sheepish, but he kept a very straight face at that point. So I guess I like the expression anyway, and you'll probably hear me using it from time to time. On to verse 43. And the Eternal said to Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. So more details about how to keep the Passover, which, by the way, is on the 14th day of the month. No outsider shall eat it, because you do eat the Passover in those days. But every man's servant who is bought for money, when you have circumcised him, then he may eat it. So only circumcised Israelites were to eat, you know, the Passover. And that's why today we say only baptized members of God's church can partake in the Passover, because baptism, in a sense, is where we are circumcised in spirit. A sojourner and a hired servant shall not eat it. In one house it shall be eaten. You shall not carry any of the flesh outside the house, nor shall you break one of its bones. And we know later that Jesus Christ did not have his bones broken. Typically, the Roman soldiers would come along to people who had been crucified, and to speed up their departure, they would break their leg bones. And then, of course, they would die shortly afterwards. But when it came to Jesus, of course, he'd already been speared to death, and so they didn't break his bones. And this is obviously part of that prophetic detail. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And you keep Passover by eating it. And you keep Passover on the 14th, because you eat it on the 14th, because it all takes place on the 14th. Verse 48. And when a stranger sojourns with you and wants to keep the Passover to the Eternal, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as a native of the land. For no uncircumcised person shall eat it. And to us, no unbaptized person should partake in the wine and the bread. One law shall be for the native born and for the stranger who sojourns among you. Thus all the children of Israel did. As the Eternal commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. So it came to pass on that very same day that the Eternal brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt according to their armies. I think we'll get through chapter 13 perhaps, but not much more today. Verse 1. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, sanctify to me all the firstborn. Whatever opens the womb among the children of Israel, both of man and animal, it is mine. You know, the firstborn had just been killed in Egypt. Now God says he wants the firstborn of Israel to be sanctified to him. And Moses said to the people, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt. So that's therefore the 15th day, out of the house of bondage. For by strength of hand the Eternal brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. And of course that's what takes place from the 15th day. On this day you are going out in the month Abib. And it shall be, when Eternal brings you into the land of the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and the Amorites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, any other ites over there, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep this service in this month. This service being the unleavened bread. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. And on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Eternal. So again it says, you know, you've got to eat unleavened bread for 7 days. Not for four or five or three, but all seven. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days. And no leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. There's two things have to happen. No leavened bread is to be seen. That's the word is kametz in Hebrew. No leavened bread is all to be gone. And no leaven, kametz, if you like the spelling, is a C-H-A-M-E-T-S. We'd probably say chametz, but I think it's pronounced kametz. No leavened bread, right? No bread itself with leaven is to be seen. No kametz. Nor can leaven, the Hebrew there would be C-R-S-E-O-R, no leaven either. No bread and no leavening products. That would be like yeast, baking powder, bicarbonate of soda. So no bread and no leavening. We had, again, one minister try to tell us 1 year that it was okay to keep bread in your freezer. You shouldn't eat it during the 7 days, he said, but it's okay to keep, you know, leavened bread in your freezer. And then after the 7 days are up, you just open your freezer, take it out, defrost it, and away you go. Buttered toast within half an hour. Nice idea, but the scripture says no leavened bread. And equally, no leavening agents. The lot have got to go. Verse 8. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Eternal did for me when I came up from Egypt. It shall be as a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes, that the Eternal's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Eternal has brought you out of Egypt. And it's important to remember that Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread are two separate ordinances. Passover pictures the death of Jesus Christ, his shed blood for our deliverance. And on Passover, that's what we look to. The Feast of Unleavened Bread pictures something entirely different. It pictures putting leaven out of our lives, putting out sin from our lives, and becoming much more attuned and obedient to God's law. And that's why it says here that you keep unleavened bread, it says, verse 9, you keep the feast as a sign that the Eternal's law may be in your mouth. The essential purpose of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is to focus on God's law, on law keeping and living up to God's standards and putting out, you know, the contamination of carnality and sin in our lives. So Passover, Christ's death; Feast of Unleavened Bread, God's law and commandment keeping. Two quite different. The Jews merge these together. They have Passover essentially on the 15th, and they're unable to separate the two distinct meanings. Verse 10. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year. And it shall be when the Eternal brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, and gives it to you, that you shall set apart to the Eternal all that open the womb. That is, every firstling that comes from an animal which you have, the males, not the females, but the males, you know, shall be the Eternal's. So you have to separate and sacrifice the firstborn male of any of the animals. But every firstling of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. The donkey would be unclean, of course, whereas goats and cattle and so on would be clean. And if you will not redeem it with a lamb, then you shall break its neck. And all the firstborn of man among your sons, males again, you shall redeem. You know, God's dealt with the firstborn in Egypt, and now he's making special arrangements for the firstborn in Israel and the firstborn, you know, of their cattle and livestock and so on. Again, it's driving home a message about how God looks at things. You can say here in the sense that you're passing over the firstborn of the flock to God. Verse 14, so it shall be when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this? That you shall say to him, by strength of hand, the Eternal brought us out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that the Eternal killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animal. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Eternal all males that open the womb, for all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be as a sign on your hand, and as frontlets between your eyes, for by strength of hand the Eternal brought us out of Egypt. So again, you know, the kids would ask, why do you do this? Why is it that the firstborn of the flock you always sacrifice to God? What's this all about, Dad? And so it would remind people of their escape from bondage, remind them of the mighty, powerful deliverer who brought an empire to his knees in just about 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks, who delivered a slave people by mighty miracles out of the Egyptian empire. And so the teaching would be there continually from father to son to grandson and so on. Verse 17. Then it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that way was near. You could sort of go out of Egypt heading more or less north and cut up towards what we call Israel today quite quickly. It wasn't a particularly long journey. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. So they went a indirect route. They went really more due east of where they were. We're going to skirt round east and up towards the north eventually, arriving, as would happen, a few months later at the Promised Land. Of course, in reality, it was about 40 years later when they got there. And the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. If you think about, 2 or 3 million people, plus herds and flocks and a mixed multitude and donkeys and asses and carts and all the rest of it and all your belongings, you have to be fairly well organized. You can just go bumping about all over the place, higgledy-piggledy and like a ragtag army. It's got to be done a bit more, better organized. And if Moses had been a general in the Egyptian army as a younger man, which Josephus says he was, then I guess Moses would be fairly well skilled at organizing people together in the best possible way to allow for fast transit by foot. And Moses, verse 19, took the bones of Joseph with him, for he, Joseph, had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you, and don't leave me behind when you go. So they took their journey from Sukkot and camped in Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And the Eternal went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. So, another continuous miracle. This great cloud would appear, which would shade them somewhat from the sun in the daytime, but would light up and give them light of a nighttime. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. And that was designed in many ways to be a great comfort to them. If you had been scared and been downtrodden, were a slave people and you lacked character, which they clearly did, and you were very worried and nervous about going into this this wilderness, where there'd be dragons in this wilderness probably, things that eat you up and monsters and so on, and wild men, then, here's physical evidence before your eyes that God is with us. God's on our side. And, for you and I, we've been delivered by our Passover from bondage to this world. We're now making our way to the Promised Land, the coming kingdom of God. And for us also, we should not forget that God is as keen to deliver us and protect us and direct us as he was ancient Israel. He gave them evidence, and really we've got evidence too. If we turn just two more scripts before we finish, we turn to Romans 8:31. Romans 8 and verse 31. God was trying to inspire these Israelites that there he was as their provider and protector, this mysterious, powerful, miraculous cloud. Verse 31, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? You know, for you and I, making our, sometimes it seems difficult journey through our wilderness, we need to remember at all times, as Israel nearly always forgot, but we should remember that if God is on our side, if God is for us, you know, who could be an effective enemy? If God's on our side, if you and I are close to God, walking his way and following his lead by his spirit, then if God is for you, if God is for me, of whom then should we be afraid? Answer, nobody at all. Let's turn to our final scripture, Psalms 27. Psalms 27, and we'll read verses 1 to 3. Psalms 27, starting in verse 1 and reading through verse 3. Again, just remembering that, you know, Israel had that physical demonstration of God being with them. You and I have something more important. We have faith in the true God, but he's as real to you and I, should be, and his power and his protection are as real to you and I. Verse 1, the eternal is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Good question. Whom should you and I fear? Who's more powerful than God? With God and us, we're always in the majority. The eternal is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked came against me to eat up my flesh, my enemies and foes, they stumbled and fell. Though an army should encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war should rise against me, in this I will be confident. So, you know, David understood that you and I should have that confidence, that assurance that God is with us, leading us surely, securely and safely through to the promised land, if we, of course, follow the directions he gives us. So that's more or less it for today. We've only done, I think, two chapters there, Exodus 12 and 13. But 12 is a very detailed chapter, detailed for a reason. And with all the deception and confusion in the Church of God, I think it's important to spend some time on that. And like I said a couple of times now, I have written an article which goes into it in more detail. And if you want to have a copy of that to go through it with your Bible and so on, happy to provide one. Okay, with that, brethren, we'll conclude the Bible study, Bible reading for today.